So, you know, you always want to give it as sexy a title as you can, but this is actually about law enforcement, the relationship between law enforcement practices and underage drinking. I don't make strong claims about causation. So I want to acknowledge my research team and disclose that I don't have any financial relationships with commercial interests. Okay, so this is what I'm going to try to do in the minutes that I have. The first thing is to try to motivate a little bit why I think this is an important question, the relationship between enforcement practices and underage drinking. It may be self-evident to many of you, but I want to make it a little more explicit. Then I'll talk about the methods that we use to look at this question, and this was based on something called the UDL randomized community trial. That's where we got the data from. Present our results and discuss them a little bit. Okay, so why is this an important question? So I think conceptually, there's interest in several different ways in which law enforcement, a variety of law enforcement practices might affect underage drinking. The first is the kind of classic idea of demand reduction or deterrence. And that is that if you make it, create a credible sense of that a kid is likely to get punished, get caught by law enforcement for attempting to buy alcohol or possess alcohol, or for intoxication or for DUI, that they'll not pursue those things. They won't drink or try to get alcohol or drink and drive. The other idea that has really come to the fore in the past 15 years or so, I think, is this idea of supply reduction, to reduce the availability of alcoholic beverages to youth. And this involves, of course, a whole different set of enforcement practices, things like compliance checks, like we've heard about earlier, and a focus on social providers as well, people who provide alcohol to underage people. Of late, there's also, I think, a lot of interest in this idea of what I call, and some others call, place-based or place-focused enforcement. And this is the idea that the focus is really on the locations where particularly dangerous drinking or risky drinking might occur. And an example of that is social host ordinances and party ordinances that try to target house parties. So I would argue that this constellation of approaches has really proliferated over the past 15, 20 years. And just as evidence of that, for the past 10 years, there's been something called the UDL program, which the evaluation of which is where we pull our data from. UDL stands for the Enforcing Underage Drinking Laws Program. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a few moments. But it started 10 years ago in fiscal 1998 and involves grants to states to try to address underage drinking. Another example is how widespread compliance checks are now. We've heard them mentioned several times on this panel. And a couple of years ago, we published data from a national survey of local law enforcement agencies and found that in larger cities, cities with populations of 25,000 or greater, 74% of those agencies reported at least conducting at least one compliance check in the 12 months preceding the survey. So it's not a real high standard. It's just trying to find out whether they're doing any. And so a lot of local law enforcement agencies are doing some of this kind of enforcement. MIP enforcement, minor in possession is what MIP stands for, is really a mainstay of local law enforcement. If you talk to local law enforcement officials, A lot of them do a high volume of MIP or related enforcement. And of course, DUI enforcement, as we know, has proliferated in the past 20 years, I think promoted in part by the advent of the Movement Against Drinking and Driving, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and NHTSA funding for DUI enforcement. So there's a lot of this sort of enforcement going on out there. But I would argue that we really don't have good answers to the question of what is the relationship between of this variety of law enforcement practices and underage drinking. There is some evidence that's suggestive of an effect. You know, I mentioned a number of studies here, CMCA, CMDA, with Alex Wagner and his group when he was at Minnesota. The Community Trials Project that Harold Holder ran. But I think the issue with a lot of these studies is that they're not component level. They're kind of kitchen sink interventions. So they involve not just enforcement, but community mobilization, policy efforts, a variety of related efforts around an environmental model. So we don't really know what contribution enforcement makes to those. Okay, so how did we try to look, at least in a very preliminary way, at this question? So as I mentioned, the UDL program began in fiscal year 1998, and it's run by the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, who is our funder, by the way, for this study I should have mentioned at the outset. Each year, OJJDP, which is part of the Justice Department, provides grants to state governments to support underage drinking prevention. There's an annual block grant to each state of $360,000, and then discretionary grants awarded on a competitive basis. It's a total of $25 million in funding per year, as long as there aren't any earmarks, which there are fewer these days, as we know, because of what's going on in Alaska. So our data are from the 2003 discretionary grant program. We worked with OJJDP and PIRE, which is the Pacific Institute on Research and Evaluation, which is the technical assistance contractor and trainer for the program, to try to move the discretionary grant program to more of a best practices model in terms of programming and something that could be evaluated using a randomized community trial approach. So we have five states that participated in the FY 2003. I guess I have time for the geography quiz. All right, so this is an easy one. Everybody knows that's Florida. And actually, I won't do this as a quiz. I'll just say that we put this state in as a credit to Karen, who focused on Missouri. That's one people don't always get. California, what about this one? This is one that stumps people sometimes. Connecticut, yeah, this is a tough crowd. And this is New York. At the end, if you come up and tell me which state never had a president that was born there, in view of this being the election season, I'll give you a throat lozenge. There's only one state, and it's not Missouri, Harry Truman, of course. So in honor of Karen, I chose Missouri to illustrate the design. So this is our statistician flipping a coin. What we did is these were communities that had, states had to apply for these funds. They had to nominate at least 14 communities that would agree to be randomized and had populations between 25,000 and 200,000. And there were a couple of other requirements that I won't go into. We then paired these communities based on a variety of community characteristics and then randomly assign them to be intervention or comparison communities. So we end up with a total of 68 communities. Okay, so data are from two different sources, from a youth survey and a law enforcement survey. The youth survey, you can read, you know, what the purpose of the youth survey was.
The sample was RDD, random digit dial type sample of, we shot for getting 100 kids between the ages of 14 to 20 per year in each community. We weren't always able to achieve that, especially in the smaller communities. And the mode was telephone. This is the survey design. And so what we did is we took the sample that we got in 2004, and that was a cross-sectional sample, and we took the 14 and 15-year-olds and treated them as a cohort and followed them longitudinally, and then repeated the cross-section in 2006 and 2007. However, for these data, we just look at our baseline. We just use our baseline data from 2004. So in addition, our law enforcement data are from a survey that we did as part of the evaluation of this initiative. So you can read the purpose of the law enforcement survey. The sample was the police chief and the sheriff, two separate agencies, or the designee that somebody they assigned or delegated to in each community. It was done by telephone, and we got a pretty good response rate, 73% in 2004. Okay, so in terms of the analyses, these are multivariate analyses that I'll show you. Because the variables that we looked at, the predictor variables having to do with enforcement levels, we used median splits so in other words, high levels or lower levels of the various variables that I'll show you. And the outcomes that we looked at were past 30-day purchase attempts and binge drinking. And all analyses controlled for age and gender and clustering by community. This is just a sense of the demographics of our youth sample. And this is what their drinking behaviors looked like. For the most part, comparable to national data for this age group of 14 to 20-year-olds. And this is our this is what our law enforcement agency survey looked like. If you look at the last row, a big variation in the size of these agencies, which we measured by the number of sworn personnel. Sworn personnel are people who can arrest you. And so you can see there's a big range, as you would expect, given that these communities ranged from 25,000 to 200,000. You can see the levels of the different kinds of enforcement methods, and also you can see that how skewed the data are in terms of just the proportion doing this, each enforcement technique. So that's why we ended up using a quantitative measure, and that was skewed, so we did the median splits. Okay, so here are the results. So on the vertical axis, we're looking at the odds of a kid reporting, of one of these 14 to 20-year-olds reporting that they had attempted to purchase alcohol in the 30 days preceding the survey. And these are predictors that were significant at the 0.05 level. So what this is saying is that in communities where law enforcement reported more clerks cited for sales to youth, DUI emphasis patrols, citations for false identification, and citations for purchase or possession or use, there were lower levels of purchase attempts. And the way these are interpreted, for example, for clerks cited for sales to youth is that it was an odds ratio of 0.7, so substantially lower than in the reference communities. So that's good. That provides some evidence that there's at least in terms of correlations that there's a, and this is a multivariate analysis, but using our cross-sectional data that there's some relationship between these policing practices and rates of purchase attempts by kids in these communities. But what about actual drinking? What about binge drinking? Well, we found the same thing for binge drinking. We found that a number of the enforcement practices were associated with lower levels of binge drinking, or the lower probability of reporting binge drinking by the youth in those communities. Businesses fined for sales to youth, clerks cited for sales to youth, and sobriety checkpoints or roadblocks. So, you know, I think this provides some evidence that police practices, in fact, are associated with youth alcohol behaviors, both purchase attempts and binge drinking. It was interesting because we looked at the self-reported priority of the agency with respect to this sort of enforcement, furnishing to underage people, sales to underage people, and youth purchase and possession, and found no relationship there, only between actual reports of practices. So probably we'll end up calling the paper Talk is Cheap. One other thing that I thought was interesting is that to the extent that we believe these associations really reflect a relationship, that it's evidence, I think, of a comprehensive approach may be what's called for, because we found that practices related to trying to address commercial availability, DUI enforcement, and even a youth focus, which I've argued, which I've been skeptical about in some things that I've written in the past, but if you believe these associations, there seems to be evidence that all of these things may play a role in decreasing purchase attempts and binge drinking. Bunch of limitations. So cross-sectional data, as I mentioned, these are self-reports. And probably the biggest one is that we haven't included community characteristics in these models yet. And it may be that there's some underlying community characteristics that are associated with both high levels of enforcement and lower levels of youth purchase attempts and youth drinking. So that's the next level of analysis that we need to do. I think beyond that, there's a real need for, first of all, longitudinal research on this question, and using experimental designs. Now, the community trials I mentioned earlier used experimental designs, but as I said, they looked at a lot of other things beyond enforcement. They looked at community mobilization, they looked at media campaigns, they looked at policy efforts. So I think it's important to try to disentangle and do some component level evaluation. So this is our website. We don't have this data up yet, but we have a number of other papers, and I think I have time for a couple of questions. Yes. The law enforcement survey was 73%. The youth survey, it's real tough to calculate a response rate for an RDD survey because many attempts are made and we don't know if they refused whether it was an eligible household or not. And so depending on your assumptions about that, the response rates are somewhere between 25% and 75%, roughly. But it's tough given the RDD nature of the survey to report a response rate. We do know that it is pretty reflective of the communities that we surveyed, with some social class and race bias that you would expect in a telephone survey. We under-surveyed non-whites and lower SES folks. Yes. Yes, these are the question was, were these results from the five states? And they were from those five states, which you guys identified so easily. Yes? Yeah, so the question was a little bit more about the methods we used for the law enforcement survey and whether there were different response patterns for depending on who, whether it was the executive in charge or somebody else who reported. So although I said it was a telephone survey, we actually send them a pre-notification letter with a copy of the survey so that they can look up things beforehand. And then often they just end up sending it in. And you know, so it's submitted by fax or mail. And Young, I don't know that we've ever looked, we probably should at some point look at whether there are differences. I think early on we looked at whether there were differences by who was reporting and didn't find any, but that's a good question. I'll have to go back and look at that again. Any other questions? Questions for, I think we have time for maybe one or two questions for the panel. Starbucks? Let's all give the panel a round of applause.